you can be building your ad councils, you can be trying to lead within your department, but the companies that probably win here, it's going to come from the C-suite. You're going to have support from on high, and you're going to have a leader who has a vision to transform the organization over the next 5 years, because I think that's probably the window of opportunity for most industries is you got 3 to 5 years to figure this out, basically. Welcome to the Artificial Intelligence Show, the podcast that helps your business grow smarter by making AI approachable and actionable. My name is Paul Raitzer. I'm the founder and CEO of Marketing AI Institute, and I'm your host. Each week, I'm joined by my co-host and Marketing AI Institute Chief Content Officer, Mike Kaput, as we break down all the AI news that matters and give you insights and perspectives that you can use to advance your company and your career. Join us as we accelerate AI literacy for all. Welcome to episode 95 of the Artificial Intelligence Show. I'm your host, Paul Raitzer, along with my co-host, Mike Kaput. We are coming to you early this week. It is 7:20 a.m. Eastern time on Monday, April 29th in our world. So, always the disclaimer, if anything crazy happens on Monday that doesn't make the show, that is why. It's interesting week. Like, it didn't seem like a crazy news week. Not a lot of breaking stuff. No major new tech emerging that we saw. No major funding announcements. And yet there's some really fascinating topics to cover that I think continue to sort of set the stage about where we are and where we're going, both in terms of like regulations, some evolving models. And, the first big thing we'll talk about today, Mike, is a couple of examples of these AI emergent companies. And I think this is the kind of stuff like I've been anxious to be able to get to on the podcast, like the real applications of companies that are actually doing this the right way, like full blown adoption across the enterprise. So, no major breaking news yet. Something happens while we're talking here, but I think some really valuable stuff for people today that can help you along your path. So today's episode is brought to us again by Rasa.io. Rasa.io is the ultimate game changer for AI-powered newsletters. Rasa.io's smart newsletter platform tailors your newsletter content for each and every subscriber and automates tedious newsletter production tasks. We've known the team at Rasa.io for years now and think their solution is well worth checking out. Join the 500 plus organizations leveraging Rasa.io and get a personalized demo today at Rasa.io/MAII. I've mentioned this on one of the previous read-throughs on Rasa.io, but like Mike and I use it as an internal newsletter. So we don't run our Institute newsletter through it, but we actually find it really helpful just for internal research purposes because it'll send us, links to look at and things like that. So it's one of the sources that we use to actually curate the weekly news. So it's another potential use case you can think about for smart newsletters like that. And then the second is, we've been mentioning this, our 2024 State of Marketing AI Survey is in the field now. You can be a part of that research. This is the, what did we say, Mike? Fourth year?
This is actually year four. I misspoke on the last episode. Yeah.
Okay. So year four of this research. So we've got fascinating research going back 4 years now, where we take a deep dive into what is actually going on in artificial intelligence within the marketing industry. Look at use cases, how people are thinking about it, obstacles for adoption within enterprise. We're asking questions this year around, do you have generative AI policies? Do you have responsible AI principles? Like really trying to get deeply into the understanding of where the market is right now with AI adoption. So we'd be appreciative if you have a few minutes and can be a part of that survey. It is stateofmarketingai.com. You can go there. You can download the 2023 report and click the link at the top that says 2024 survey and be a part of that research. We will be releasing that in summer of 2024, so coming up in a few months. So again, stateofmarketingai.com to be a part of that research. All right, Mike, it's all you.
All right, Paul. So you alluded to our first big topic today, which is we're seeing a couple new case studies come out that detail companies becoming what we would call AI emergent. And these are existing firms that are reinventing their businesses with AI. The first case study details a partnership between Moderna and OpenAI to deploy ChatGPT Enterprise to thousands of employees across that company. According to OpenAI, quote, now every function is empowered with AI, creating novel use cases and GPTs that accelerate and expand the impact of every team at the company. They also say that within 2 months of ChatGPT enterprise adoption, Moderna had 750 custom GPTs they had created across the company. 40% of weekly active users were creating GPTs, and each user had on average 120 ChatGPT conversations per week. Now, within Moderna, this is happening across literally hundreds of possible use cases across the business. They've got a GPT to review clinical data using some of the data analysis capabilities that ChatGPT has. They have GPTs that their legal team uses to summarize contracts, and they have GPTs that help employees get quick answers about internal policies at the company. Now, as we heard this, we also got an article that contained a detailed breakdown from Asana co-founder and CEO Dustin Moskovitz about how the company evolved to integrate AI into every aspect of their operations. That included building bots for feedback, for reviews, for sales and customer experience, and for content creation. So it sounds like Asana also took this kind of similar approach to Moderna, despite them being very different types of companies, in the sense that they empowered employees to go find their own use cases and build their own tools for their specific roles and needs. Moskovitz even details how everyone from SDRs to product marketers to HR professionals were able to actually identify high-value AI use cases in the company and build AI tools themselves to support their work. And he noted multiple times they often didn't really have significant technical backgrounds. So, Paul, this caught our attention for a few reasons. But first up, can you kind of maybe talk a little bit more about what we mean when we say AI emergent companies and why it's so important to be looking at these types of case studies?
Yeah, I was so excited to see this case study. I mean, I get like it's a case study from OpenAI. It's going to be obviously very favorable. It's certainly, you know, adoption in enterprises isn't this seamless, but you know, the whole point here is just to see the depth of commitment that was made to integrate AI. And I think it's a great representation of what organizations should be thinking about and pursuing. So going back to the AI emergent concept, so I wrote a blog post, we'll link to it in the notes, and I had to go back and look when I wrote this. It was May 16th, 2022. So set the stage to May 2022, Midjourney was a couple months old. We had DALL-E had been previewed. I don't think it was readily available yet. Mike and I were finishing the manuscript for our book. So our book came out in summer of 22, the Marketing Artificial Intelligence book. And we were, about 7 months prior to ChatGPT being introduced. Mm. So that's kind of the stage we were at, but we were already seeing at that point, the inflection point was arriving in our opinion as to like, we really were going to have this future where, as I wrote, you were going to be AI or obsolete. And so I'll just like pull a few excerpts from that post because I think it's very relevant. And what we're now seeing is kind of these companies we envisioned are now coming to life. So in that post, I wrote, with each day that passes and each advancement in artificial intelligence, language and vision technology, is becoming more apparent that there will be three types of businesses in every industry: AI native, AI emergent, and obsolete. I keep running through examples in my mind. I said retailers, e-commerce shops, marketing agencies, media companies, law firms, medical practices, keep going. And I can't come up with an industry or business model where this won't be true. I went on to write, take any of these or your own business and simply look for inefficiencies and repetitive processes, opportunities to drive revenue through greater predictive models, such as customer acquisition, retention, and growth, and ways to unlock ideation and innovation through previously unattainable creative possibilities. You could later add the generative capabilities to that as those became readily available to people. And then in that post, we went on to describe AI emergent companies as established organizations that move quickly to adopt and scale AI across all areas of the organization. They have visionary leaders who see the rapid advancements in AI capabilities and invest the resources needed to build a smarter business. These emergent companies have expanding AI and machine learning talent pools, And at the time I referenced, Adobe, for example, had 300 AI ML employees at that time, according to LinkedIn. They innovate faster than the competition, potentially through venture studios or R&D labs on building AI tech, and they excel at personalization across marketing, sales, and service. They have the data, customer bases, and infrastructures to withstand the AI native companies, so the startups that are building AI first, if they move fast enough to transform. Plus, they have the money to acquire the AI native companies before they grow to dominate. So that just sort of sets the stage of, like, going back to 2022, how we were looking at sort of the future of business. And then you fast forward to today with this Moderna example. And the thing I love about, I mean, I don't know if GPT-4 wrote the case study, but it's a really well done case study. Mike and I used to write case studies and things like this for clients back in our, you know, agency days. This is really well done because what I loved is they led with the why. So it said Moderna is using its platform for developing mRNA medicines to bring up to 15 new products to market in the next 5 years. In order to achieve its ambitions, Moderna has adopted a people-centric, technology-forward approach, constantly testing new technology and innovation that can increase human capacity in clinical trials. So they basically kind of lay out the fact that they're having this unparalleled growth opportunity. And at one point, they actually literally say that this would take thousands of people to do if they weren't using AI. So the CEO is quoted as, "We believe very profoundly at Moderna that ChatGPT and what OpenAI is doing is going to change the world. We're looking at every business process," and this part I love, "from legal to research to manufacturing to commercial, and thinking about how to redesign them all." So this is, like, again, go back to the AI emergent definition. It's a visionary leader. Like, you need someone who's looking out his head and saying, this isn't just like a marketing thing. This is an every function of the organization thing. And we're going to, like, aggressively push this. Then it went on to say that their objective was to achieve 100% adoption and proficiency of generative AI by all its people with access to digital solutions within 6 months. Quote, "We believe in collective intelligence when it comes to paradigm changes. It's everyone together, everyone with a voice, and no one left behind." Then they said they had individual change management initiatives, including in-depth research and listening programs, as well as trainings hosted in person, online, and with dedicated AI learning companions. They had prompt writing competitions to find the top 100 AI power users. They had local office hours with every business line and geography, with over 2,000 Ackley Week of participants. Structured change management initiatives, including engaging Moderna's CEO and executive committees. And then there was a quote in here from their chief information officer, Brad Miller, said 90% of companies want to do Gen AI, but only 10% of them are successful. And the reason they fail is because they haven't built the mechanisms of actually transforming the workforce to adopt new technology and new capabilities. This is exactly what we've been saying, Mike. Like, like, people complain that it doesn't have the impact it should have, and the models aren't smart enough, or they make mistakes. And the thing we always say is, you're not thinking about this the right way. You're not properly training everyone. Like, you can't just buy the tool, give it to everyone, and think it's just going to happen. So they went on to say, you cited a couple of those metrics, but they said within 2 months, they had 750 GPTs, 40% of weekly active users had created a GPT, and each user had 120 ChatGPT enterprise conversations per week on average. And then there was a section, the final section on the cloud, is this idea that said a team of a few thousand can perform like a team of 100,000. And this is where the quote came from, said, "If we... with an ambitious plan to launch multiple products in the next few years, Moderna sees AI as a key component to their success. Quote, if we had to do it the old biopharmaceutical ways, we might need 100,000 people today. We really believe we can maximize our impact on patients with a few thousand people using technology and AI to scale the company." So I don't know if anything else caught your attention, Mike, but this is, like, again, the thing I keep saying and keep thinking when we talk to these big enterprises is, like, You this goes everywhere. It's every function of the business, and you have to be educating people first and foremost, and then you have to give them, like, the resources to actually explore what's possible with this technology, and then encourage all this sharing. So I love everything about what they feature in this case study.
Yeah, like you mentioned, obviously it's never as seamless as it appears, just operating on a single case study. But I think people would be wise to look at the numbers again. Look at how many conversations your average employee is having. If you are coming away dissatisfied from these tools because you had three or four conversations and it didn't cut it, they're having 120 per week. It's going to take hundreds of conversations to even begin to get towards what you want. Is that kind of what you took away from this in terms of not only the education piece, but people do need to actually invest a large amount of time and trial and error to get these tools to work well?
Yeah, it's viewing it as transformation, not just tool use. You know, I think that's the companies that go in saying, we believe this is going to transform our workforce, our strategies, our technology stack, and we're going to approach it as such. We're going to put the right resources. We're going to build the right infrastructure, put the right governance in place, like not just go get five tools to be testing and hope people figure out how to get some value out of the $30 a month license that they're using. So, yeah, I think it's just the organizations that take that approach. And then you mentioned Asana. It is a different approach because they're coming at it most likely from a product first standpoint, because Asana is a project management system platform, if you're not familiar. We're big fans. We've been using it since, I don't know, we started using it right before at the agency. So probably a decade or so been using Asana. We use it to run the Institute from a project management perspective. So Dustin Moskovich, who you mentioned, if people aren't familiar, he was actually one of the co-founders of Facebook, and then he left and founded Asana in 2018. You may see his name in the news otherwise, because he's currently has beef with Elon Musk. I will not disclose, like, go check Elon's Twitter thread from Friday. I was messaging Mike when I was sitting at dinner. I was like, what happened? What did I miss? I was in a talk at Ohio University Friday afternoon, and Elon Musk put this really inappropriate tweet up about Dustin. And I was like, what happened? And Mike's like, man, I had no idea. So I found out what happened. There's been a lot of beef emerging between the two, but basically he said that Tesla is the next Enron, that it's the whole thing is a big scam. And Elon is basically just like selling this future vision of full self-driving that's never going to happen. And so he basically just called Elon out and said it was Enron. So Elon was not very happy with that. So Dustin in news for other reasons you may hear about, but back to Asana. So the way they're approaching it, similar thing. You have a CEO with a vision for how this is going to transform the company. So they're looking at it from a product perspective. But the thing I liked about this example is it was a letter from Dustin. So it was very clear that this is coming from the top. And they're a company that has been investing in AI for a long time. Like, we've talked about this before. AI isn't new. Like, ChatGPT wasn't the beginning of AI. There were companies like Asana, like Salesforce, like Adobe that had hundreds of AI and ML engineers way before ChatGPT emerged. But they were working on machine learning. They were working on predictive models. They were making predictions about outcomes and behaviors that could be applied to like forecasting models and recommendation engines and optimization of pricing and like things like that and products. Well, what they're doing now is he's saying like, okay, we were already in AI, but now we're really in, and like, we're really seeing the potential of generative AI, not just within our product, but within our own company. And so there was one point he said internally, reactions to AI range from exhilaration to skepticism. We knew we needed to build literacy and hands-on experience to unite everyone around this transformation. Again, transformation, not just tools. So we launched an internal AI community and immersive workshops, encouraging all employees to tinker with the technology. We stood up Slack channels. We started evangelizing the power of AI through new internal use cases and stories of our personal breakthroughs at company all hands and in team meetings. And then it just goes on to say kind of how they got everyone involved, and they began to glimpse a future where AI moves beyond isolated chats to embedded contextual collaboration, kind of their own use within this. So definitely another one to just keep an eye on. They do say they have a Work Innovation Summit on June 5th that we'll track, where they said, quote, we'll be showcasing the future of human AI teamwork. And then he ends with, together, let's build a future where every team has the power of AI at their fingertips, where human creativity and machine intelligence combine to solve the world's greatest challenges, and where work is not just more efficient, but more fulfilling, more impactful, and more profoundly human. That is like something I would have read. Like, that is exactly what we've been saying all these years. More intelligent, more human is the tagline we've been using. So I love the vision. I love what they're trying to do. We're not using any of the AI features within Asana, to my knowledge, today. So, you know, I think we need to probably dive back in and see if there's anything going on. Certainly, you know, two good examples today of just this whole vision of it's got to come from the top. Like, you can be building your AI councils, you can be trying to lead within your department, but the companies that probably win here, it's going to come from the C-suite. You're going to have support from on high, and you're going to have a leader who has a vision to transform the organization over the next 5 years. Because I think that's probably the window of opportunity for most industries, is you got 3 to 5 years to figure this out, basically.
So in our next big topic today, Microsoft has announced the PHI-3, PHI-3, family of open models. And these are noteworthy because they're actually small language models, or SLMs. According to Microsoft, SLMs, quote, offer many of the same capabilities found in large language models, but are smaller in size and are trained on smaller amounts of data. Now, because these models are much smaller than LLMs, they consume far less compute, and they can run locally, or have the potential to, on devices like an iPhone. So one of the main models in the family, PHI-3-mini, has 3.8 billion parameters. It was trained on 3.3 trillion tokens, and Microsoft says it performs better than models twice its size. There are some other PHI-3 models coming soon with more parameters. 7 billion and 14 billion have been mentioned by Microsoft. And while large language models are basically unmatched right now for complex tasks and the most advanced use cases, the reason this is kind of a big deal is that these small language models can perform really well on a lot of simpler things that can make AI more accessible and easier to use for organizations with limited resources. Small language models can also be more easily fine-tuned. Sonali Yadav, who's Microsoft's principal product manager for generative AI, said the following about this trend. Quote, what we're going to start to see is not a shift from large to small, but a shift from a singular category of models to a portfolio of models where customers get the ability to make a decision on what is the best model for their scenario. So, Paul, I found this trend really interesting in terms of what it could mean for AI adoption. Like, how do you see small language models potentially increasing or streamlining how organizations actually adopt AI?
For just some macro level context here, again, the reason why these models are important is because it costs a lot of money to run the big models. So, you know, we're building GPT-4, GPT-5, or Gemini 1.5, or Claude 3, Opus, like the biggest frontier models, to use those models. So training them costs hundreds of millions or billions of dollars. That's one thing. But then the inference costs. So when you and I go to use the tool for whatever it is, to write our emails or to generate our images or eventually to generate our, you know, 10-second videos, that's the inference cost. So if you're using these massive models every time you need to do a discrete task, it can get insanely expensive. So for Microsoft, who's licensing OpenAI's technology to do, say, 365 Copilot, it's built on OpenAI's GPT-4 or 4.5, whatever it is, technology, it costs them a bunch of money to pay OpenAI to use it every time you or I go in and use Copilot. So there's a lot of motivation to build these smaller models that don't cost as much money. And what the research seems to be showing recently is, as you alluded to, you can train these things a little easier. There's been a number of research reports just in the last few weeks that shows that the quality of data matters a lot. And that if you can take a smaller model that costs less to train and costs less to run, and you can give it more kind of hand-picked data sources, that these things can perform like a much larger model in terms of their quality and reliability if the data is really good that goes into them. Apple actually has released a number of research papers showing this is the direction they're going, where you build these smaller models that don't cost as much to run, don't cost as much to train, and they can run on device so you don't have to go to the cloud every time you wanna do something. So again, every time you or I go into ChatGPT or Perplexity or wherever, we're going and pulling from compute in the cloud somewhere, which costs money. What they're saying is in the future, you could be on your device on do not disturb or airplane mode, and you could be running a model doing something on your phone. That's what this means. And so that's why you're going to hear a lot more about this as we lead into the June developer conference for Apple, this on-device models that can do things for you on your phone without an internet connection is going to be a really big unlock. And I think it will lead to a lot more adoption. And it's probably going to be much more like the adoption we had in the 2011 to 2020 range, where we were all using AI in Netflix and Spotify and YouTube and Facebook. Like, AI was part of our lives and we didn't realize it. That's what this will enable, is like that these models can just be underlying functions on your phone and you don't even know you're using AI. It's not like you're going to a AI app to use AI. It's just going to be embedded within everything.
So in our third big topic today, we got news that Sam Altman, Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella, and Alphabet CEO Sundar Pichai are joining something called an AI Safety and Security Board that's being run by the U.S. government. Now, this board is going to advise the Department of Homeland Security on how it can safely deploy AI within critical national infrastructure. So it's going to do things like make recommendations on how operators of core infrastructure, like power grids, for instance, can protect their systems against AI threats, those kinds of topics and advisory recommendations. Now, almost 24 political, tech, and business leaders are on this board. So some of the other notable names include NVIDIA's Jensen Huang, Anthropic CEO Dario Amodei, the CEO of Northrop Grumman, the mayor of Seattle, who's also the chair of the U.S. Conference of Mayors Tech and Innovation Committee, the governor of Maryland, and noted AI researcher Fei-Fei Li. Now, Paul, when we talked about this before the episode, you mentioned that there were some notable omissions from this group that stood out to you. Who was that?
Yeah, so I mean, the obvious thing is Meta's not on there, so no Zuckerberg, no Jan LeCun. You could say Elon Musk, who's certainly investing a lot to build AI. So there was some obvious ones there. And then the biggest one that initially jumped out to me is, what were the open source people? Like, so a lot of the people on here from the AI perspective are you know, not the big ones pushing for open source acceleration. So that seemed to be one thing. There was, I did see a tweet from Gavin Baker, who, you know, I follow pretty closely. He's a managing partner and CIO at an investment firm, but heavily involved in AI. And he tweeted, can't decide whether it is funny, ridiculous, or sad that the CEOs of Occidental Petroleum and Delta Airlines are on the new AI safety board. Less than half of the 22 members have any real AI knowledge. Also odd that it's not even vaguely bipartisan, has zero open source AI CEOs and excludes Elon. So that was my initial, like, that was actually one of the first times I saw this list. And then when I went back in and read about it, it actually made a lot more sense. Like, what his critique, I think, didn't necessarily hold up, at least from the business perspective, because this is all about critical infrastructure such as the power grid and transportation. So it makes perfect sense that someone from a petroleum company, someone from an airline company, like, you would want diversity. They don't have to be AI experts to be able to explain how transportation in the United States works, or how the energy grid works, things like that. So it's actually smart to have a diverse group of people that can bring that kind of knowledge to the table. That doesn't mean that there shouldn't be open source people on there. Someone like a Zuckerberg shouldn't be on there, but I think they're basically probably looking at which companies are we working with on the infrastructure of the US economy and the government, and then what businesses are represented that need to be there. So yeah, I mean, my overall take was, I think it's good that these conversations are happening. The infrastructure is something we don't talk about on this show much. We probably will more. It is a major problem. There are lots of things that can go wrong with the infrastructure. And in many cases, the infrastructure is 70 years old or more, and that's a problem. And it's an attack vector for people to use. So yeah, and then the other thing, we'll come back to this later on, but there was there's a new bill, SB 1047 in California, Safe and Secure Innovation for Frontier Intelligence Models Act. that is apparently moving pretty quickly in California. Mm. And this seems to be a bit of an attack on the open source world as well. At least it's being positioned by some open source advocates as such. Jeremy Howard, who is someone we follow on Twitter, posted an article about like his thoughts on this. Mm. So he's an AI researcher and entrepreneur, CEO of Answer.ai. And so he goes on as to kind of like do a takedown of why open source is so important. So I think, again, we'll kind of come back to this maybe next week. I think it's worth talking a little bit more about this battle between open source and closed source as we start moving into regulations. But it's going to be a really important topic as we move forward, especially as we start getting into the elections and as the government starts looking at ways to, you know, protect infrastructure and things like that. So, yeah, really critical topics. Keep an eye on SB 1047 in California. It seems like it's moving real fast.
All right, so let's dive into some rapid fire topics this week. The first up is a pretty interesting public comment from Sam Altman. He recently made a public appearance at Stanford's Entrepreneurial Thought Leaders Seminar called ETL. And he had some harsh words to say about ChatGPT. At one point in the discussion, he said, quote, ChatGPT is mildly embarrassing at best. GPT-4 is the dumbest model any of you will ever have to use again, by a lot. But it's important to ship early and often, and we believe in iterative deployment. Now, Paul, this isn't some groundbreaking secret knowledge interview that he's dropping here, but it was something I wanted to highlight because I think many people who are relatively new to AI don't always grasp just how much leaders like Altman believe existing AI technology is going to improve and soon. And you also mention this point in your talks all the time, saying this is the least capable AI you'll ever use. Could you kind of unpack this idea a little more for us?
Yeah, you know, I think it is just a good reinforcement that, you know, people look at GPT-4 today and maybe they are disillusioned. Maybe there are some organizations or some leaders out there who just don't see the real potential for transformation. They're not doing what Moderna or Asana are doing, and they're not, you know, really driving it because they just don't see the value. So one, I think it's a really good reminder that it's only going to get better from here, and it's probably going to get significantly better from here. And the other thing that I thought he gave some good perspective on is he said this in many, many interviews, that it's better that they don't just go build. So again, their mission is artificial general intelligence, AI that is at or above human level at all cognitive tasks, generally speaking. And so his feeling is like, we don't want to just go away and build AGI and then just drop it on the world in, you know, 2 years, 5 years, whatever. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, like, where did this come from? Like, if we had never seen ChatGPT, if we'd never experienced these tools as they were evolving. So OpenAI does iterative deployment. So they're a big believer in, let's ship this stuff early, ship it often, and give people a chance to react to it. Now, if we rewind back to, I think it was GPT-2, when it first came out, they put out a paper, said, hey, we're not releasing this into the world because it might be too dangerous. So they were worried about GPT-2 being misused. Now people are worried about GPT-5 and, oh my gosh, what's going to happen to society? And so Sam's whole point is like, listen, there's this initial shock when new things come out, like ChatGPT comes out, everyone freaks out. And so then he said GPT-4, which came out a year ago, was met with 2 weeks of freaking out. And people believed it was this crazy thing and the world had changed forever. Now people are like, oh, it's horrible. Where is GPT-5? So his whole point is like, as a species, we adapt. Change is weird. I've referenced the one that Andrej Karpathy said at one point where he was talking about like Waymo. Like, most people don't realize like self-driving is actually a thing. Like, there are taxis basically in California that don't have drivers and you can order them on your phone and you can get in them. Well, the first time you see that, you're just like, what is that? And then you continue walking down the street and like you go about your life. And so I think like as much as AI is going to transform everything, like it's going to be this process where things just start to be weird and you're going to look back 2 years and be like, oh my God, I can't believe GPT-4 was like what we were using. That was such a terrible tool. But right now it feels very impactful. And so I think that's the path we're on with this technology. But Sam's point is, listen, we'll keep figuring it out. Now, I don't necessarily buy into this when it comes to like the jobs and the workforce and the economy conversation, which is a whole another topic. This is the approach of most of these technology leaders is like, hey, we adapt, we figure things out. It'll all be okay. And like, we'll have time to solve this. So yeah, there was a few quote worthy things from the interview at Stanford for sure.
It certainly sounds like he does not think progress on AI will be slowing down anytime
soon. No, he does not. Yeah. And he's been very clear that the leap to five is going to be massive. Mm-hmm. We will see. Hopefully, well, I don't know, hopefully, but we'll probably see sooner than later.
See. All right. Another topic on the docket this week. We got a new in-depth report from a publication called Rest of World, and it details some really significant challenges that are being seen building out AI infrastructure in the U.S. The article does a deep dive into TSMC, the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company. This is one of the top AI chip makers on the planet that makes AI hardware basically possible. And it's currently engaged in efforts to build and staff a chip fabrication plant in Arizona. So this plant has right now about 2,200 employees. It's kind of seen as this leading indicator of efforts to diversify AI chip manufacturing away from Taiwan, just given the geopolitics of that region and kind of great power competition between the US and China. But this appears to be a lot easier said than done, because this report, which is well worth a read, details tons of obstacles that TSMC is running into trying to get this plant up and running. And primary among these aren't just, you know, technical hurdles. There's serious cultural clashes between American and Taiwanese ways of working. The report details how Americans had to go train at TSMC in Taiwan for like a year, but all of the training were in Taiwanese and Mandarin Chinese. So they were basically hacking it together with Google Translate to learn what they're supposed to learn. There were also some significant clashes with TSMC's work culture, which is, quote, notoriously rigorous even by Taiwanese standards. And Taiwanese engineers were also coming to the U.S. and then very critical of their American counterparts' work ethic and technical skills. All of this is to say, you know, Paul, we hear a lot of talk from AI leaders about the need to invest billions or even trillions into AI infrastructure like this in the coming years, especially in the U.S. But it just sounds like there's some serious human obstacles here. I mean, could this type of thing hold back AI innovation?
Yeah, and it's totally predictable. Like, so if this is an interesting topic to you, one, it probably should be. Just if nothing else, you understand the supply chain that powers your smartphones, your cars, all the AI tools that we rely on today, all the ones we rely on in the future, they are all dependent upon TSMC and the supply chain of building these chips. Also your retirement portfolio, potentially, if you invest in NVIDIA. Now I did hear an interview with Jensen Huang where he said that they are relying on TSMC in Taiwan, but of the 35,000 parts that go into each chip, only 8 of them are made by TSMC. So it's not like the whole chip is fabricated like in Taiwan, but it is a critical part for sure. So this affects everyone. The article is insane. Like, it's a long read, but it is like, it's comical at times, but also sad, because it's just, as you said, like, I don't know how you've solved this. Like, and there are, The CEO of TSMC has basically said for years, like, you can't do this in America. Like, this isn't going to work, but I'll take your $10 billion and we'll try and build this in Arizona for you, and we'll see how it goes. And it's mainly a culture and labor issue. Like, they're just very different in Taiwan than in America. And that becomes extremely apparent when you read this article, that it is probably more misaligned than you could imagine to try and do what they do in Taiwan and in the US. So two quick recommendations: Chip War by Chris Miller, great book on the topic. And then there's an article from Forbes by Rob Towse called The Geopolitics of AI Chips Will Define the Future of AI. That article is from May of 2023, and I believe the book came out in 2023 as well. So again, if you're fascinated by this thread of AI, start with the article on Forbes from Rob Towse. Great insight into it. He also had a TED talk on the topic, I believe. And then if you want to keep going, read Chipboard by Chris Miller. It is a fascinating topic. It's one of those, like, I try and not spend too much time in because it's like, I have no control of this whatsoever. And there's times where you read this stuff, you're like, oh, this is going to go haywire. Like, this is not going to work out. And I feel kind of helpless. So I like, it's kind of like cybersecurity. Like, I'll dip in every once in a while, read about it. And like, I got to get out of here. Like, I got too many other things to worry about than the supply chain for AI chips. But it's a fascinating topic.
All right. Next up, Meta has announced that it's expanding its Ray-Ban Meta smart glasses collection to include a bunch of new styles, but more importantly, new, more powerful AI. So we had talked last week about Meta AI, the company's intelligent assistant. And now in the US and Canada, you'll be able to use that right within your smart glasses. So you just say, hey, Meta, and you can then prompt the assistant with voice commands. Now, Meta AI also gives the glasses the ability to access real-time information, and the company began testing a multimodal AI update, so you can actually ask your glasses about what you're seeing. Now, that update is now rolling out to users in the US and Canada. So, Paul, it definitely seems like Meta's Ray-Ban smart glasses could be like an actually useful way to engage with AI in the real world. We've talked a couple times in the last couple weeks about AI wearables and that whole trend. Like, how do you see these stacking up compared with some of the other, unfortunately, rocky releases of AI wearables?
Definitely a better form factor. A lot more positive buzz regarding these than, say, our humane AI pin or the rabbit, which we won't get into. But the rabbit, if you recall, we talked about, I don't know, 10 episodes ago, 15 episodes ago, when it was first previewed. It's this device that supposedly does AI on it. At the time, I was kind of skeptical that it was, one, needed, and two, would work. It is real bad so far. So they just started getting into the hands of people, and it's not... I don't know if it's as bad as the AI pin reviews, but it's real bad. Probably just because it only costs $199 instead of $799. So people are more like accepting of the fact that they just wasted $200. But the rabbit device is not going well. The Ray-Bans, however, seem like right form factor. Obviously, Meta has endless money to throw at this, and they seem to be being really smart. I tried to find some sales data on these things, and the only thing I came up with was August 2023. At that time said they'd sold 300,000 of the devices, but only had 27,000 monthly active users. So adoption wasn't real high. But again, it's not a wildly expensive product, so it can be somewhat disposable if you're a higher income person. It's like, you know, throw $300 at something, don't like it, it's okay. I could see these being more heavily adopted for sure in the months and years ahead. And I think more people will get into this space. I would be shocked if Apple doesn't at some point apply their Vision Pro technology to this. And by the way, we should come back to the Vision Pro at some point.
Yeah.
That's not going well either. I mean, awesome tech, like at least they have good tech, but it's not being supported. Like no new apps, no new immersive experiences. Like, I don't know what they're doing. And apparently they just cut production like down to 400,000 units instead of 700,000. So yeah, I think there's just going to be, it's going to be a rocky go with these kind of immersive experiences and AI devices, even for the big companies. But Meta seems to be on track here more than most.
So we just also got some news that a new AI startup being backed by former Google CEO Eric Schmidt has just emerged from stealth with a whopping $252 million in funding. This company is called Augment, and it aims to challenge GitHub Copilot by offering a better version of an AI coding assistant to help programmers be more productive and effective. So essentially, AI assistants that will generate code for you, help you debug code, and help you create programs much faster. Now, the company was actually co-founded by an ex-Microsoft developer and a former AI research scientist at Google. They are entering, however, a pretty crowded and competitive market. GitHub Copilot has 1.3 million paying individual customers and 50,000 enterprise customers. Amazon and Google have their own coding assistants, and there's a ton of other startups competing in this space as well. Now, Paul, while we don't have a ton of details just yet on this company, it has raised a significant amount of money, has some notable investors. Its founders have interesting and relevant backgrounds. These kind of tick all these boxes we look for when it comes to paying attention to certain companies. Like, what are your first impressions of this?
Yeah. So we, on a recent episode, we talked about, you know, what startups get our attention. The investors, the amount of investing, the founding team, sort of like check, check, check. And this one, Eric Schmidt, if you're not familiar, he was the CEO and chairman of Google from 2001. So just a couple of years after they were founded, he was sort of the adult brought into the room basically to kind of guide Google. And so he was the CEO till 2011. And then he stayed on as the chairman of the board, I think until 2015 or 18. And so he's, you know, a billionaire, and he invests heavily. He advises the government. I think the Department of Defense, he's like an advisor for AI there. So he's heavily involved still. And so to see him leading this kind of round for a company to come out of stealth with $250 million, that's going to get your attention. And certainly the co-pilot is, the GitHub co-pilot is one of the very early, seemingly highly reliable uses of AI. Like, we're seeing it really impacting the coding world. And so you're going to see some competition flow into this space. So yeah, just again, things that kind of perk our ears up is when you hear $250 million in funding and see Eric Schmidt's name tied to something, and the founders from Google and Microsoft, definitely a startup worth paying attention to.
All right. You know, it wouldn't be AI news without Elon Musk being in the news again. Elon Musk's AI company, xAI, which makes Grok, the AI assistant that he has, is reportedly close to raising $6 billion from investors that include Sequoia Capital. This raise would value the company at $18 billion, and according to the information, it's expected to close in the next 2 weeks. Now, according to their reporting, the company is currently training the second generation of Grok on 20,000 NVIDIA H100 chips, and Musk has also indicated that the company needs 100,000 GPUs to train Grok 3.0. So that's likely where at least some of this money is going. But really, kind of a big question I have here, Paul, is like, we both have been pretty underwhelmed, but with Grok, like in our initial tests, is this kind of valuation justified for this company or this tool?
I mean, Elon sells visions. Grok is useless right now still. If someone has a use for Grok, like, please reach out to me and tell me how you're using the thing. I just don't understand, like, what it's supposed to be doing. But he sells visions, like, we're going to go to Mars, we're going to electrify the world with cars, and you know, that's his thing. And so I'm sure he's just pitching some grand vision for AGI and its embodiment into robots and how it's going to accelerate, you know, getting to Mars and, you know, saving the planet. So and he can get money from people, whether it's Sequoia or, you know, other government funds is certainly a place he tends to tap, which creates some of the friction between him and the U.S. government, as Elon's very friendly with other governments that the U.S. doesn't necessarily want him to be friendly with. And because it's a source of money for him. So yeah, I don't know. I guess keep watching Grok. Maybe it'll do something at some point. I don't know. But yeah, I wouldn't be shocked if he raised this. I wouldn't be shocked if it was more money than this. Like, he can raise whatever he wants, probably.
All right. Next up, we have gotten news that Apple has started back up discussions with OpenAI about using its AI to power new iPhone features coming later this year. This comes from some reporting by Bloomberg. These discussions revolve around the terms of a possible agreement between the two companies that would integrate OpenAI features into iOS 18, which is the next iPhone operating system. Now, earlier this year, Apple and OpenAI apparently had been talking, but it looks like those talks had stalled until now. Apple is also in discussions with Google to potentially license their Gemini models for use in their products. So, Paul, these are still discussions and rumors, not any actual deals yet, but you're a longtime Apple watcher. Like, why is Apple engaged in trying to use AI from other companies rather than building their own?
I think they're doing all of the above. I mean, who hasn't Apple had talks with at this point, or at least reported to have talks with? So I don't know. I mean, but Apple's done deals with everybody for the iPhone at different times. So nothing would shock me if they do a deal with OpenAI or Microsoft or Google. Like, I mean, they're frenemies. They're sometimes they do deals together and other times they're competing against each other. So I'm not surprised by any of it. I have no idea what they're going to do. It seems like it's going to be a mix of their own models. So again, if you read the recent research reports coming out of Apple, which they're not historically like one to put out a bunch of research.
Yeah.
So they've been talking a lot about their investments internally with AI. So I think there's just going to be a mix, and it may be that they're not fully baked yet with their internal models. And so they're going to do deals with other companies until they feel that their models are, you know, ready for prime time. I don't know, but they're going to do something. Like they're going to make some major announcements in June. And I would expect that by this fall, the way your phone works is probably going to start to evolve. Like we're going to experience AI on device as soon as this fall.
Mm.
So one way or the other, definitely something to keep an eye on.
All right. Our last story this week is about HubSpot, because HubSpot just unveiled its most recent Spotlight. So this is a product showcase the company says it's rolling out twice a year to kind of highlight new parts of its various hubs and other products. And AI played a starring role in this one, because HubSpot says it has started to embed AI across each one of its hub products, across marketing, sales, and service. And this Spotlight showcases some of the latest AI features. And these include things like a feature called Clip Creator, which generates videos from text prompts, an AI-powered automatic reply system in their service hub, the ability to turn written content into audio with AI-powered blog post narration, the ability to create reports automatically using generative AI and text prompts. There's AI-powered brand voice, which generates content that sounds like your company. They have now predictive AI to forecast sales performance and much, much more. Now, Paul, we've obviously got a very long history with HubSpot. You know, this isn't the first time they've released AI features, but how do you see these updates kind of fitting into HubSpot's overall AI trajectory?
They're pushing out a lot of updates. They're really logical use cases. It's good to see them keep making innovation. I saw some chatter just in like the partner channel. I'm still like observe. I'm not involved in it anymore, but just that like people are struggling to keep up with the update. I think there was like over 100 things in this Spotlight. And the way they released it is like this page that's just like this infinite scroll page of updates. I don't know if there's like a way to download this. Like I was having trouble, honestly, like kind of even figuring out what was going on and what all the updates were and what we have and don't have as a company.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, we, as you said, we use it, and I'd love to know like, okay, which are the things that actually matter to us? I'm not going through 100 things and figuring out what to actually use here. Maybe they could build an AI bot that advises you on what to use. That's connected to your hub that says, hey, going back to like 2008, they used to track like individual usage of individual apps. It's how they knew how, you know, their happiness factor for a customer is based on your app usage within the platform. And that was reported to partners. Like they know what we're using, what we're not. Like maybe I could talk to their little AI chatbot and it could tell me like, here's ways you could use AI. Like that would be cool because this is a lot to process, but good to see them continuing to push out AI updates for sure.
All right, Paul, that's a wrap for this week. We really appreciate, as always, you breaking down what's going on in AI this week. Just some final notes here. I would just highly encourage anyone who's getting value out of the podcast to please leave us a review on your podcasting platform of choice. It helps us get the podcast into the ears of more listeners. And I would also just reiterate, if you do have a few minutes and you haven't taken our State of Marketing AI survey yet, please go to stateofmarketingai.com. We are keeping the survey open for the next about 6 weeks here, and we'd love to hear from you about how you're using artificial intelligence. It should only take a couple of minutes for you to fill out, and it helps us move the industry forward by publishing really robust research on AI adoption. And then last but not least, please go check out our newsletter, This Week in AI, at marketingaiinstitute.com/newsletter. It covers more in depth all of the news we discussed today and also all the topics we don't have time to get to. So it's a single comprehensive brief to get you caught up on AI in just minutes that comes out every week. So if you haven't signed up for that, I highly, highly encourage it. Paul, until next week, thank you again for breaking it all down for us.
I have a feeling this week's going to like make up for last week. I think there's going to be a lot happening this week. So we will be back with you next week reporting all the news that matters to you. Have a great week, everyone. We'll talk to you again soon. Thanks for listening to The AI Show. Visit marketingaiinstitute.com to continue your AI learning journey and join more than 60,000 professionals and business leaders who have subscribed to the weekly newsletter, downloaded the AI blueprints, attended virtual and in-person events, taken our online AI courses, and engaged in the Slack community. Until next time, stay curious and explore AI.